Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the hours after the high school shooting in Parkland, Florida, students spoke out against the violence in a barrage of televised interviews. Meanwhile, another story was spreading online claiming that some of those students were so-called crisis actors who were coached to push some left-wing agenda. This has become the norm. Whenever a major tragedy occurs, right-wing extremists start peddling conspiracy theories on the internet. Social media helps those fake stories reach larger audiences. Washington Post tech reporter Drew Harwell covered these online hoaxes in the aftermath of the Parkland tragedy. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Drew Harwell.
Thank you.
When did this get to be a thing?
Really soon after the shooting. I mean, you can see, going back to the message boards as we did, even in the minutes after, when everybody's starting to engage with the news, understand what's happening, even as sort of the police are on the scene, you can see people first question what happened and then start applying the narrative they wanted to exist. They started questioning the race of the shooter. They started wondering if there was some nefarious scheme underfoot. They started questioning how the media was responding to it. So you could see, I mean, this wasn't really people trying to understand the tragedy. This was sort of people applying the storyline they wanted and seeing how they could frame it as they liked.
Why?
You know, that's hard to know. I mean, a lot of these people are anonymous online, and I think it probably breaks into people who either just do it for laughs because they have this kind of sense of humor and they think it's funny, to people who really do believe in the conspiracy, really do believe that this was maybe a false flag operation orchestrated by the government and that these kids were crisis actors, all this sort of, you know, crap, effectively. So it ranges, but they all end up having the same purpose. They all end up having the same sort of mission, which is to undermine the kind of mainstream understanding of the event and affect what they call the normies, like, you know, break their viewpoint into mainstream argument and get their way in this way where they may not otherwise be able to.
This obviously isn't the first time this happened. The time that would it really... I think reached the public consciousness was Sandy Hook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sandy Hook was a huge episode for this kind of conspiracy scandal too, and it's just awful. But you know, even in the hours after, and even now, I mean, 6 years later, there are still these conspiracies all over YouTube and Reddit and all these sites where people gather suggesting that there was some conspiracy, that it was all faked. And, you know, a lot of this stuff happens in these dark corners of the internet, but it plays in this very public space where we all have to engage with it. And a lot of some of the parents of the Sandy Hook victims and survivors are still followed by these conspiracies. They're still harassed. Some of them feel like they can't have social media. Anytime they go on TV, they're flamed as a crisis actor. So, you know, even as the rest of the world moves on, this counter narrative is still given fuel by these anonymous people and in these boards that aren't really doing that much to police against it. And so you just see how misinformation gets spread and evolves and grows while the rest of the world moves on.
Reddit's the most familiar. Talk about these boards and how they're used.
Yeah, so Reddit is broken down into a number of what they call subreddits. They are applied to different topics. A lot of them are normal, cars, books, that kind of thing. But there are others that are really kind of pushing the limits of what's allowed, what should be sort of talked in public. You know, there's boards. One is sort of devoted to conspiracies. One is devoted to kind of alt-right speech. And, you know, a lot of users on Reddit don't like these boards. They think they go too far. They wish that the administrators would crack down a little bit more. But in those boards, they're almost like their own little fiefdom. And those people can make threads sort of putting forth an idea, putting forth a meme. You know, you saw on Reddit a lot of these people were posting pictures of the survivors of Parkland and saying all sorts of heinous things. And you could see, I mean, those ideas would start on those boards, and they would proliferate. They would make it onto videos on YouTube. And within days, you could see those sorts of ideas were suddenly on the news. People like David Hogg, the young student at Parkland, who was mm-hmm. on the news a lot talking about this tragedy, you know, he even had to go on CNN and say, I'm not a crisis actor. And at that point, these communities saw that as a victory. They saw that as breaking from their niche of, you know, their corner of the web into this very public domain. That gave them power. That they felt like that gave them influence, and so that's something we have to be patrolling against, because this is the way that lies spread, and they really affect people's lives.
A Reddit conspiracy thread regarding the Democratic Party actually led to a shooting in 2016 in Washington, D.C. That was the pizza parlor that was supposedly the front for a child human trafficking ring. Mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of responsibility does Reddit take for something like that? You know, there's a lot of focus on Facebook and Twitter, but not as much on Reddit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're going to have to confront the reality that these ideas are gaining power on their platforms. And if they're not doing anything to push back on them, they're only going to proliferate. I mean, we saw with the Pizzagate stuff, that was an idea that I'm sure some people shared because they thought it was funny. Some people shared because they really thought it was real.
The shooter obviously did.
Yeah, and the shooter really did. And so, yeah, and you know, I talked to some of the conspiracy-minded people about this, and some were saying, you know, this is an idea. We can't control what sort of acts of violence happen because of this idea. And yet, and I think a lot of people would think that's crazy. But, you know, Reddit has been fairly quiet about this. One of their administrators yesterday sort of went on and said a little bit about what they're doing to confront hate speech. But you can still go on Reddit right now. It's a very public website. You can find it via Google and find a lot of this really sort of damaging, even sort of deceitful misinformation. So I think, you know, these platforms like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and Reddit, they've for so long subscribed to this theory that they're a neutral platform, that they're just the town square. They can't control what people say when they're there. You know, it's this very grand ideal of free expression, but it becomes really dangerous when this sort of misinformation is given a place to take root and to spread. And so I think they're starting to, I mean, you see companies like YouTube hiring a ton more moderators mm-hmm. to ensure that the content is following their policies, but we're still so far away from an ideal situation. And you know, this could happen again.
How big is Reddit? Can you sort of define that site for us?
It's actually really, really big. I don't have any numbers, but you know, and it's not at a YouTube level. But for a lot of people, it is the homepage of the internet. I mean,
right.
There's, you know, you can subscribe to a number of subreddits. I go on Reddit often for reporting and just for fun. You know, there's a lot of healthy communities on there. There's a lot of people who are trying to share common interests, but it's those boards where these really troubling ideas take off. Places like r/conspiracy, and there's a board called The Donald that's kind of like a alt-right sort of troll board. And you see how easily it can be corrupted. You know, and a lot of these people are anonymous, just like they are on boards like 4chan and 8chan. And when something like Reddit, which is very big and probably has millions of subscribers, does try and crack down, what it ends up being is like a game of whack-a-mole. They mm-hmm. maybe delete a thread, but similar ideas pop up elsewhere. And so, you know, this is an ongoing problem. Without like a real structural solution, we're going to keep seeing misinformation on these platforms. We're going to keep seeing these viral lies really take off. And you know, it's easier to make a lie and spread a lie on something like Reddit than it really is to tell the truth and spread the truth and eradicate these kinds of rumors, because they evolve, they spread. And at that point, you know, even some people say engaging even with the lie becomes becomes difficult because it's almost like you're validating it. So, you know, I think it has to go to the structure of these platforms and how they, you know, help spread this information, because otherwise no one else is going to be able to crack down on it alone.
What kind of evidence is there that these sort of fake news things are coordinated campaigns?
Ian, that's a great question. You know, a lot of after these big news events, there's always going to be people saying things on the internet that are wrong. That's just something we have to be accepting of. How much coordination is there is, though? That's kind of the interesting question. And after Parkland, I was really surprised at what looked like moments of coordination, moments of you go on a board like 4chan that's or 8chan that's kind of like a Reddit with fewer rules, and it's people not just sort of sharing the lies or sharing the memes, but calling on others to spread widely, keep digging. You know, this is what we need to do to either interrogate or learn more about these school shooting survivors, or this is what we need to do to spread whatever misinformation we have already. And so, you know, in these anonymous communities, it's hard to really know how big the group is, how serious everyone is. But we saw these calls, you know, these calls to mobilize, you know, post after post after post, where people were saying, this is fantastic. We're finally breaking through to the mainstream. Keep digging. And one post was really, I think, was most surprising to me. It was somebody who was saying, you know, this is information warfare, and we've got to go to war. I mean, this, and sort of broke down a playbook of this is what we need to do to gain information on people like David Hogg, who's, again, a high school student. This is what we need to do to spread this information that we either believe is true but is definitely misinformation. And, you know, if people start to not care anymore about the shooting or start not talking about gun control, lay off. Let's just recede back into the shadows. That, I mean, it's just so interesting to see this coordinated, almost tactical approach to sharing these corrupted ideas.
Why do people fall for this?
That's a good question. You know, it's interesting on the internet that you can go on YouTube right now and search for something like flat earth theories, saying that the earth isn't round, it's flat. And you can probably get thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of videos, either engaging with the idea or knocking down the idea. If you are predisposed to believing crazy things like that, clearly, you may be swayed by even the volume of the amount of videos. And you may even feel like maybe this is a theory that is true, but that the mainstream media is keeping me away from because it doesn't want me to know. And if those videos are taken away, you're maybe even more convinced that there is some sort of secretive plot here to fool you. And so it becomes this almost impossible task for people who want to believe this. We saw this with the Parkland stuff. The craziest theories, you know, if YouTube would delete a video, you know, saying these kids were crisis actors based on zero evidence, those people would say, okay, well, we're clearly onto something, because if our research wasn't valid and we weren't, you know, on the trail of something good, then why would YouTube delete it? Why wouldn't they just let it exist? So it becomes this almost self-fulfilling lie, and that they want to believe that storyline. They want that narrative to be true, and so they do whatever they can to spread it as widely as they can.
Do people see this as a new normal, or is there some way people can start to check themselves more thoroughly when they're consuming this sort of material?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the platforms obviously have a responsibility, but the people who engage with the news, and I mean, all of us, we all have a responsibility to know what we're sharing, to think about the source of the information, and to check our prior beliefs. I mean, to maybe question the things that we see on something like Facebook or YouTube or Twitter before sharing it, before, you know, taking up arms to defend it. This fight against misinformation is not going to stop. I mean, the internet is an incredible platform for sharing ideas, and a lot of those ideas are going to be bad ones. Mm-hmm. We have to, I think everybody who wants to be a responsible consumer, spreader of news and information needs to come to a reckoning with the fact that it's going to be a constant battle for figuring out the truth. This when we gotten to this point of democratizing content, as they said, you know, where everybody sort of has a voice on the internet, there's an incredible amount of good things that come out of that. Mm-hmm. But there's also a danger here, and that you are open to voices from everywhere and people who are actively trying to maybe deceive you or to spread what they think is the truth, but it's not. I think that's, unfortunately, it's not a fight we can stop fighting, but it's something that we need to pay more attention to.
Drew Harwell, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Drew Harwell is the artificial intelligence and big data reporter for The Washington Post. He covered online hoaxes in the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida high school shooting. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Back in the olden days, when you lost your way on a road trip, you would pull over to consult a map or maybe even ask somebody for directions. In the world of smartphones and digital maps, losing one's way is mostly a thing of the past. Senior associate editor for The Atlantic, Julie Beck, recently wrote about how getting lost has changed in the age of digital maps. We have a link to her story at WOSU.org/AllSides. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Julie Beck.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Digital maps predate smartphones. MapQuest first launched in 1996. I must have printed out 1,000 maps. They were good in a way. They were better than a regular map. But what happened back in 1996?
Yeah, I think the launch of MapQuest was kind of like the beginning of the sort of constantly connected mapped like era that we live in now. But obviously, it was like a little less intense, right? Because you got to remember, you have to have an internet connection at home. Not everybody did in those days. You got to remember to look it up, to print it out, that the wind needs to not blow the paper away as you're like walking around, right? So I think that began this sort of decline of reliance on maps or on like learning the directions yourself. It's obviously a far cry from like having a map on your phone in your pocket at all times.
Hmm. What about those standalone services such as Garmin? People put the GPS devices on their dashboards with suction cups or on their window. What they became very, very popular before the smartphone too, right?
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. You know, people, the GPS technology sort of existed, and it wasn't necessarily at the point where smartphones were democratized yet, and so people, people wanted to take advantage of that technology. And so it makes most sense to sort of make devices for cars and things like that. And I think people still use those sometimes. But a lot of times your phone has kind of the same functionality.
Well, and now your car does too.
Yeah, exactly right. If you have like a modern car.
Just got one. And it does make a difference. Google Maps has become dominant. What did Google do differently when it was launched in 2005?
Oh, you know, I don't really know the details of their technology. I think, you know, my understanding is that for a while they had a partnership with Apple so that like the maps that were built into your smartphone were Google Maps, but then they kind of had a a falling out or a divergence, and now Apple has its own map service and Google has its own separate app. You know, I think that what I'm trying to think how to answer your question of what is different about it. I think it may just be the ubiquity. I don't know that when it launched, it was necessarily any different than MapQuest, but mm-hmm. over time, right, it's become very dominant and not perfect. Not everywhere is mapped, but a lot of places are.
I remember Google World. That was a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. I remember you would always like look up Google Earth and like zoom in on your house or whatever. and even that was not perfect. I think we have a certain tendency to think, especially if you live in like a relatively populated area, that, you know, the world is totally mapped now. And like, we're pretty much done with being lost. It's not a thing that can happen anymore, so long as you have a phone and it's charged, right? But that's not really true. There are plenty of rural areas, especially in the United States, that are not mapped well at all. Even in places that are mapped, like I was talking to someone who spends a lot of time in Asian cities, and the roads are not always clearly mapped there either. So I think we risk having a bit of a myopic view when we say, like, oh, it's like getting lost is totally obsolete now. I think it's changed, but I don't think it's over.
We're talking about getting lost in the age of smartphones and Google Maps. My guest is Julie Beck. She's a senior associate editor for The Atlantic. She recently wrote about how getting lost has changed in the age of digital maps. Questions or comments? Do you have a story about getting lost? We all do. 614-292-8513. Julie Beck, your piece in The Atlantic gathers together various stories about people getting lost. Why did you decide to collect these stories?
Oh, you know, I think I went into this with maybe like the false expectation, like we're just talking about, that like people don't get lost anymore. Hmm. And I think that's like mildly true in certain ways, but not totally true. And what I wanted to do was just collect sort of like an oral history of the last times people can remember getting lost. And I had this theory that, you know, a lot of them would be clustered like right in that era before smartphones kind of reached saturation. And a lot of them were. But a lot of them were kind of revealed to me different ways that people are still able to get lost despite having access to these digital maps, whether that's in, you know, more remote areas, whether that's they're traveling and they decided not to, you know, pay all the extra money to have the maps available while traveling. And so I think it was very interesting just to collect these kind of personal stories, because you can talk about it theoretically all you want, and like at a certain point, it's not interesting anymore. But like people's personal stories of like how they got lost and exactly how that happened, I think is super interesting.
Well, tell us one of the stories.
Sure. I mean, I'm happy to tell you mine. that was kind of what started this whole thing for me. Because I think mine was like very dramatic and like emblematic of the theory that I thought I was going to have or what have you, which is the last time I was lost was in Russia in 2013. I was a very late like smartphone adopter. I know a lot of people had them at that time, but I didn't. I was traveling for work in St. Petersburg, and I was I was there for a pretty short period of time covering this event. And I was also trying to sightsee while I was there, because not every day you get to go to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the bus, taking the public bus, and I just fell asleep.
Wow.
I was super jet lagged, and I remember like trying to stay awake, and I just couldn't. I was out. I was trying to get back to my hotel. And it was like pretty obvious, like the bus stop was right across the street from the hotel. You know, you couldn't miss it if you were awake, but I was not awake. So I woke up and I didn't know if we'd pass the stop or not. I had no idea. I went up to the bus driver and tried to ask, like, you know, have we passed the park in? He was not pleased with me. You know, he didn't speak English. I didn't speak Russian. And he was like, you're not allowed, like basically conveying you're not allowed to talk to me. So I'm freaking out. I don't know if I should get off the bus or not. Like, you know, it's kind of that moment of decision. And luckily this like very kind young Russian woman like overheard me like panicking. She spoke English and she started to try to explain to me how to get back to the hotel, but I was just losing my mind. And so eventually she got off the bus with me, which was so, so nice, and like drew me a map of how to get back to my hotel. It was pretty simple. It was just like one long main road that I had to follow. But mm-hmm. I guess I had been sleeping for a long time. And she was like, you know, it's going to take a while. Like, don't, you know, don't get afraid. Like, it's going to take you a long time to walk back. So I start walking back. And of course, I'm like still feeling very sorry for myself. I'm like all upset. What if she doesn't know what she's talking about? What if I somehow take a wrong turn on like this literally just one road that I'm walking on? You know, I'm all upset about that. And at a certain point, it was pretty late. It was like 11 or something p.m., but it was summer in Russia, so there was still a little bit of sunlight because mm-hmm. The sun sets very late there. And this random man just like ran out of the ether into like out of nowhere into my path. And he goes, do you know where McDonald's is? Do you know where McDonald's is?
Right.
And I'm like, no, I'm lost. Like, ugh. And then he goes, are you from the cruise ship? And I was like, no. Apparently there was a cruise ship that was docked nearby, and he had to get back to it pretty soon, but he really wanted to find a Big Mac before he left. He really wanted to eat a Big Mac. And then he asked me what I was doing. You know, I told him I was there for work and I was lost and blah, blah, blah. And so he said he would walk with me for a little while. So he walked with me. We talked about, you know, work and his cruise and whatever. And then I saw the hotel kind of appear on the horizon, and also the cruise ship was like right next to the hotel. So once he saw that I'd like gotten back safely or whatever, he saw someone else from the cruise a little ways away, and he just like ran off into the night. And then when I got back to DC, I shortly thereafter I purchased a smartphone, and I really have not been lost again.
Yeah, but I mean, having that kind of access to digital maps, it's messed with us. I've done interviews with social psychologists who have studied how it's changing our ability to navigate.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think if you're used to relying on a map to tell you where to go, then you don't really have to learn it because that memory has been outsourced to the device.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, you know, studies. It's not just maps. It's, you know, the very existence of the internet or having access to it means that you're more likely to use the sort of referential memory of, like, as long as you know where the information is and how mm-hmm. to access it, then you don't have to hold that information in your brain yourself.
Do you keep maps, like paper maps?
Not really. Every once in a while I will. If I'm traveling, like I might get a travel guide out of the library, or sometimes they give you maps of like this is so silly, but like if you're at like a convention center or like
yeah.
a very confusing sort of like urban place or building,
mm-hmm.
like sometimes those maps can be really helpful. Museum maps, for example, that sort of thing.
The pop-up maps.
Mm-hmm.
The fold-out maps. Are there, you know, is it mostly just rural areas where digital maps can't help us anymore? Because that's where I've gotten lost, is in rural areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big one. It's, you know, it's partly the issue of where things are well mapped and where they're not. And it's partly an issue of, like, cell signal, right? So if the area is mapped but it's just not very well covered on your data plan or whatever, that's not going to help you. And then I think also, these companies are based in the U.S., and there is, like, a bit of a Western-centric focus as to what's mapped and what's not, and how well.
Every once in a while when I'm using my digital map, you know, like Googling it or whatever, it doesn't want to be the right way. Like, I have to have my phone in a certain position, you know, to hold it up so I can look at it. And it wants to be horizontal instead of vertical. And I don't get that.
Are you talking about the little, like, blue dot that tells you where you are?
Well, just which way to turn on a road. And I'm, like, turning, like, bending in my seat trying to figure out,
yeah.
do I turn right or left or whatever? And then I had to learn about this, the whole thing with the, whether you go by car or you walk or you bike. One time it says it's going to take you 3 hours and 45 minutes to get to someplace. It was 10 minutes away by car. And I'm like, what is this? Why is it saying this? It took me a while. I'm just a moron, I guess. But
you got stuck on the walking direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that.
This will be closed for 3 hours by the time you arrive, you know?
Right, exactly. And, like, that's the interesting thing, too, is, like, in some ways, these digital maps have created new ways of getting lost,
mm-hmm.
where it's just, like, the interpretation, like, because you still have to interpret it. Like, there's still going to be human error no matter how good the maps become. And that creates, like, new opportunities where, like, I'm always getting confused by the blue dot, for example, like, which way it's pointing as to, like, which way I'm supposed to turn.
Oh, right,
so
right,
I'll end
right.
up on the street corner, like, spinning around trying to orient the little dot. And, like, if I was just, if I had just, like, figured out the lay of the land, I would already know which
right.
way to go. So it does create these sort of micro ways of getting lost that we probably didn't have to deal with before.
What about that idea of this romantic notion of getting lost and how digital maps have robbed us of that? I mean, you did get to meet that guy and you had that experience.
Right, right, yeah. And he, you know, I love, like, it's a great story. Like, I definitely cherish it. But also at the time, I was, like, very scared. Like, I didn't speak Russian. I didn't, like, if this woman was wrong, like, I would have been 100% lost. Like, I had no cell signal, no nothing. So, like, it was, like, romantic and fun and great. But at the same time, it was frightening. And, like, you to have that safety net is no small thing. Especially for women, because a lot of times you're traveling, you're vulnerable if you're alone. It feels so much safer to be able to rely on yourself. And people I talked to, you know, mentioned having to rely on strangers, like male strangers, to help get them somewhere and just being really afraid and not knowing what was going to happen. And so I think sometimes when we romanticize like a pre-technological era, we forget just the safety that certain technologies really, really afford us.
Julie Beck, thanks for talking with us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you.
Julie Beck is a senior associate editor for The Atlantic. She recently wrote about how getting lost has changed in the age of digital maps. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up with Russell Holly of Android Central. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. At the end of the day, one of the last things many of us do is plug in our smartphones. But there is more to a healthy battery than a full charge. Joining us by phone to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So a smartphone with a battery that drains quickly can be pretty annoying. I think I went through it a lot with either my last phone or the phone before that. But is just plugging it in overnight, every night, part of the problem?
This is something that ends up getting a ton of research done because there's a lot of, you know, kind of schools of thought regarding how older batteries used to work and how newer batteries are supposed to work. But there's actually a group called Battery University that's done a tremendous amount of research into how you're supposed to, you know, keep your battery if you want it to last the longest. And it's kind of at odds with how most people use their phone these days. So it's kind of a problem. You have two different options. You can either make sure that your phone is fully charged as often as possible all the time, in which case keeping your phone charged at 100% overnight is fine. Letting it drain all the way down to zero where it's completely dead and then charging it back up can actually be harmful to the battery because doing so exposes the battery to more heat than usual.
Huh.
The alternative there is to keep your phone somewhere between 40 and 80% at all times and actually never fully charge it aside from that first time. And doing so actually, you know, keeps the available stored energy, you know, at its maximum for an extended period of time. So over the course of several years, as opposed to, you know, charging it up all the way and letting it completely drain. If you do either of those two things, according to the resources available, you stand the chance of your battery lasting much longer than you would letting it, you know, completely charge and then completely discharge every single time you use it.
How would the battery makers, how long do they say they're supposed to last?
It depends on the manufacturer, but in most cases, batteries are expected to last at least 1 year at the kind of rated capacity for when you bought the thing, and then up to 3 years for within 85% of its expectancy. So like everyone knows that the battery is going to go down a little bit over time. It's really just a matter of how much and how quickly.
Does how you use the phone, maybe you listen to lots of podcasts, you look at lots of videos, that kind of a thing, or watch movies on it, does that change how the battery's life?
Absolutely. The number one thing that impacts the battery's chemistry is heat. So if you're doing things that generate a ton of heat, if you're constantly playing a bunch of video games on your phone, then that's going to cause the phone to warm up, and constantly exposing the battery to an extended period of heat. Or leaving it in the car or something like that. That is the number one thing. Really anything over 60 degrees Celsius, for extended periods of time, that will dramatically reduce the life of that battery.
So if I feel like my battery or my phone's getting warm, that's a signal to turn it off, or what do you do?
It's a sign to, if you're really concerned about the battery, to either not do the thing that you're doing for a really long time, not have it for, multiple hours or something like that, or to kind of move it to a place where it can be cooler and do the same thing. It's not something you have to turn the phone off for. The phone will regulate its own heat, back to a normal temperature, based on the activity that you're doing. But the warmer you keep it for extended periods of time, the more likely that battery is to degrade faster.
Does the case, those bulky cases, the big rubberized ones that I ought to use, the kind that make your phone bounce off the floor when you drop it, do those affect it?
They can, mostly because they can act as both insulators to keep heat inside the phone, or as heat absorbers, especially a lot of those are made of black material.
Mm-hmm.
And so leaving a phone in direct sunlight, for example, if you've got it, kind of docked in your car, for example, that black case will absorb heat from the sun much faster than, say, a clear case or a white case. And that will apply heat very close to your battery.
When do you know that your battery is shot? Can you get a new one?
It depends largely on the phone. iPhones, for example, have a battery test that you can run on the phone that's actually built into the operating system that will tell you. And most iPhones, you can go to an Apple store and have the battery just replaced there for a fee, depending on whatever it is. But most you see the kind of battery repair store or phone repair stores will have some kind of financial offering there for replacing the battery. It's usually, whatever the cost of the battery is plus $20 or $30 for labor.
There is, I'm looking on my iPhone right now, and there's a low power mode thing, and I don't have it turned on. Should I?
You should. I don't know. The low power mode is a way of saving battery for an individual charge, not charge over time.
Okay.
And so that is, if you're going out and you know that you only have 20% of your battery left, or you only have 25% of your battery left, low power mode will extend that by turning off a bunch of the stuff that the iPhone does in the background.
Okay. And then there's also, it shows me where my battery usage is. And yes, it is with a game. I feel kind of guilty now. You're right. Wow. Only 2% on photos. That's crazy.
Yeah. That's actually a surprising thing, because your camera can take quite a bit of battery power because it uses the processor more than just about any other app on your phone.
Uh-huh. But just sitting there, if you're not doing a ton of videos and photos, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Huh. Well, let's move on. I'm fascinated. I'm going to play with my phone after we get done with this. A new smartwatch is coming to the United States. It addresses the problem of the battery life as well. It's called Amaze Fitbit, Fitbip.
It does. Yeah, it does sound when you look at it, it does seem like it would sound very similar to Fitbit. But yes, it's the Amaze Fitbip. Has a P at the end instead of a T.
P is in pony, right?
That's right. And it's actually made in cooperation with a Chinese company that does a ton of stuff with phones called Xiaomi. They made this phone, this watch mostly to tackle battery life. This is a watch that claims that it can get 45 days of battery life which for a smartwatch is essentially an unheard of thing.
Yeah.
Your average Apple Watch or Android Wear watch, you're very lucky if you can get it to last 2 days. So this gives you, GPS and water resistance up to a certain point and a battery that lasts a really long time. So it works good as a fitness tracker and gives you basic notifications from your phone, if you want that kind of thing.
Why is it so much better?
It's very simple. It is not designed to run a ton of apps on the phone. It's designed to, pull the information from the phone that the phone sends to it and act as a fitness tracker. It's not designed to do a ton of extra things like you can, in theory, do with, say, an Apple Watch or an Android Wear watch, like, control the music streaming on your phone.
Oh, okay.
or do things like that. This is not really designed to do that. But the things that it does do, it does very well, acting as a sleep monitor, as a fitness tracker, and of course, grabbing the notifications from your phone.
And I'm sorry, but telling time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you really need something on your wrist to tell time, this will also do that.
I like having something on my wrist again. I got tired of having to pull out my phone when I wanted to check what time it was.
What an amazing series of problems we have.
I know. It's first world all the way. You recently wrote a post about using your phone in the shower. What's going on, Russell?
I got a lot of negative feedback. A lot of people. I started that article off by saying this is not a smartphone addiction thing. Just read the whole thing before you judge me. And I feel like very few people heeded that warning.
Well, why were you using your smartphone in the shower and what happened?
So I travel quite a bit when I go to see these things that are being unveiled, and I'm typically by myself in my hotel room at the end of the day with a bunch of stuff that I still need to do, and also music that I like to listen to and podcasts and videos and things like that. And I found myself as a way of just kind of detoxing from a day of conferences and meetings and stuff to just bringing my phone initially into the bathroom and just playing the podcast or whatever. Like a shower speaker.
Yeah.
Shower speakers are a fairly common thing. But when phones became waterproof, I didn't bother with a shower speaker and just started bringing my phone with me in the shower and leaving it in the soap caddy. And it occurred to me through a conversation that I had had with several people the week before that was a very strange thing to do. And it's not something that I do at home. It's something that it's a very specific pattern of behavior for when I am not at home.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm at home, my phone doesn't come anywhere near any of my bathrooms. But yeah, it was this thing that I shared as an idea to see if I was the only one who had done it. And amazingly, not quite 24 hours later, there was a separate article that was published, I think, on BuzzFeed by a company who made a shower curtain that was clear, that allowed you to slide tablets and phones into it so that you could continue to watch television or stream video from the shower curtain. And I'm not quite that far gone. I feel like there's probably a middle ground there. And that's
my interest, though.
To take your tablet and slide it into your shower curtain so that you can watch stuff while you're cleaning yourself?
Well, does it No. I mean, I wear my watch in the shower, though. I'm kind of, keen on that. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, there are some people who just never, ever take their watch off.
I want to get all the credit for standing and walking that I can.
Oh, for fitness tracking? That's amazing. Take extra steps in the shower so that it gets counted.
All right. Well, so people who do what you do only when you travel, do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I found was, if your phone has, kind of forward firing speakers or is focused on, kind of generating a sound in more than one place, those are a lot easier to use. There are a lot of phones that have speakers that are only on the bottom. Samsung, up until this most recent generation, was one of them. And that caused a lot of problems, kind of sound distortion and things like that. It just made it not worth using. But phones like the Google Pixel or the iPhone have speakers that are designed to kind of present it forward in a stereo format. And those feel just like shower speakers in most cases.
How many phones?
And the phone is water resistant. So.
Okay, yeah. How many phones do you have?
I'm not comfortable answering that question.
Okay. Okay. All right. So speaking of phones, we talked a little bit about the new Samsung smartphones, the Galaxy S9 and S Plus last week. The reviews are coming out now. What's the verdict? What do people think?
So generally speaking, there's going to be a lot of people taking a look at this phone over the next week as it comes out next week for people who pre-ordered it. And the general consensus from everyone who has used one so far is that it is very, very similar to the Galaxy S8. So if you own a Galaxy S8 and you are considering upgrading to the next phone, the only reason really that you would consider doing so is that the camera on this one is very, very nice. But it's a kind of marginal upgrade over the camera that you already have. Galaxy S8 camera is also very, very nice. So it is a better camera. It is not necessarily a better phone. And so that is an important distinction to make for people. This is a great option for people who have phones that are older than 1 year and are looking to upgrade. This will be a great option and will likely come with many different, promotional offers from Verizon and T-Mobile and those companies. But as a kind of standalone competitor to itself, to the phone that was released last year, mm-hmm. It just feels very, very similar.
How does it compare to an Apple iPhone X or any of the more recent versions?
So there's actually a company whose job it is to test the performance of things like cameras and processors and things like that. And the camera on the Galaxy S9 has blown away every other camera that's put on a phone by a considerable margin, and that includes the iPhone X. So it is an exceptional camera. The Galaxy S8 and the iPhone X were very similar when it came to performance and battery life and things like that over last year. So that's going to be very much the same with the Galaxy S9. This is a great phone. It is not appreciably better than the phones that you could already get in most cases.
So I'm supposed to call it an iPhone X, not an X?
I switch back and forth all the time. Apple called it an iPhone X, and that confused me because we didn't get an iPhone 9. Because the iPhone 8 is still a phone that you can buy right now.
Yeah.
So it's difficult. I switch back and forth just because I guess I can.
Okay. Nobody I just don't want to sound dumb.
No, I hear everyone use both all the time. It's definitely not you.
What are we going to talk about next week? Because we have a minute and a half left.
Next week, I think there's going to be a lot of talk about cord cutting stuff. There's a lot of things that are happening both legally and technically as far as things that people can do to kind of distance themselves from paying a cable bill. And a lot of research is being done over the course of the last month and a half as to how much cheaper it is across the country to actually make those changes. So I'm going to be talking about that quite a bit.
And the cable companies are responding how?
Oh, I have no idea, but I imagine that there are temper tantrums involved.
What else?
So there's not a ton else happening next week aside from the Google Clips camera, which is a camera that's built with artificial intelligence. And the idea is that you set it somewhere and actually don't do anything with it. The artificial intelligence inside of the camera chooses when to take pictures and video without you, and then later shows you stuff that it took. As something that you might like.
What do you think about that?
It's something that I've been messing with for a week, and I have a lot of very confused thoughts about it because the idea is cool. You can set it somewhere and then be a part of the picture. So you can be playing with your kid or with your family, and the camera will capture those things as this kind of impartial third party. But it's a complicated thing for this camera to kind of be always on and recording in front of you and then only show you little bits. It doesn't show you everything that it captured because it chooses what things it thinks you're going to be interested in.
But it has it all there.
It deletes it, but it does at one point, yes, it will have recorded all of that information.
Okay, Russell Holly, we'll talk about it next week. Thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor to Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.